This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Very good afternoon to you. And in this hour, looking at how autonomous technology is going to shape the future of the mining industry. The federal government has made some changes about the need for independent observers on all livestock export ships. And we've got some grains news to get through right at the top of the Country Hour today, because Western Australia's main grain handling body is saying that some overseas customers are starting to insist on a sustainability certification. In other words, proof that our grain has been grown in a sustainable manner. So this season, for the first time, CBH is going to run a trial supplying certified sustainable malting barley into select markets in Asia. And there's going to be a $5 per tonne premium paid to those who are accredited. Jason Craig is head of marketing at CBH. He says overseas buyers are now asking him for more detail on how our grain has been grown. And he says that's particularly so in the malting barley sector.
Look, there's some interest in the from maltsters and brewers around the world in respect to sustainable malting barley and sustainable malt. So we're looking to develop that market, and we've been working with a number of key maltsters and brewers in respect to this. And we think there's an opportunity here. Obviously, this year will be a trial, but we're hoping to extend that trial next year as these opportunities potentially grow.
So which markets want this sustainable barley?
At this stage, the markets are in Asia, and so they're showing some interest. So I think there's some good opportunity there as we move forward.
And what exactly will this certification scheme assure them of?
It's about sustainability. So it's this basically the same system as used for us to send canola to the EU, but this is called ISCC Plus, which is for sustainability certification of products that are going outside of the EU. So we see this as a great opportunity for us WA growers and their unique supply chain in CBH to be able to have a sustainable supply chain to these customers.
So you've mentioned that there could be a $5 a tonne premium for malting barley under this scheme. Will that be available this harvest?
Yes, we're going to have a $5 premium. It's only in the Kwinana and Albany zones this year. The reason being is it's just a trial shipment. And so we're working to work in those two zones to see how to make sure we can set up the system. It's an appropriate system and that the customers are happy with the certified barley.
In the Kwinana and Albany zone, will there be separate segregations for this barley?
No, there won't be separate segregations. Similar to canola, we use what they call a mass balance system. So it's really a bookkeeping system, and it's just to manage the sustainability of what we've bought and sold. So we'll continue to use that mass balance system. It requires on each port zone, hence we're using the Kwinana and Albany zone as the trials this year.
And what will growers have to do to be part of this scheme?
You've got to be a canola grower that has been ISCC accredited. You just got to fill in your declaration. It'll be a first in, first serve. And it's about selling your malting barley to CBH Marketing and Trading. You won't be able to do that online. You'll need to contact either your BRM or our Growers Service Centre to be eligible.
Who are the big markets for CBH for malting barley?
Oh, there's a number, but, you know, obviously China has been one and will continue to be. But, you know, in Southeast Asia, there's and Asia, there's Japan, Korea, certainly Vietnam and a number of other markets through Southeast Asia.
Where are we at with the Chinese claim that anti-dumping investigation against Australia with barley? Do you know where that's at?
We understand that the Chinese government under WTO rules will be required to make a decision prior to the 19th of November. So we're just waiting for the Chinese government to come back to us.
There's been some criticism of CBH that they've relied too heavily on the Chinese market for both malting and feed barley, and now this anti-dumping investigation threatens that market. Have you neglected other markets at the expense of China?
No, we haven't. I think China has been a very important market and will continue to be an important market. And, you know, there are a number of other markets, as we just discussed, that we've been developing over many, many years, including Japan, Vietnam, etc. So, but it's just that China is, due to the population, has been a large market for malting barley and for the beer industry.
It's certainly an uncertain market at this stage, though, isn't it, for this season?
Oh, certainly. I mean, we will know in November, obviously, the decision by the Chinese MOFCOM, by the government, and we will go from there.
Jason Craig, he's the General Manager of Marketing and Trading at the CBH Group, talking to Emma Field about the fact that for the first time, CBH is going to be running this trial, supplying certified sustainable malting barley into select markets in Asia. 11 past 12, and we did hear some rumours today, just speaking of CBH, that the co-op has just laid off 150 receival bin casuals. And I asked CBH about that before coming to talk to you today and just got a response back on the email. It says, each year CBH Group assesses the harvest casual requirements in line with the crop estimates for each of the operating zones. And due to a smaller harvest and the closure of a couple of sites for this year, CBH Group will employ less harvest casuals in the Geraldton zone for the 2019-20 season. There was no bulk termination of harvest casuals, says that email from CBH. On the Country Hour, 12 past 12, and just back to the topic of certification in the grain industry. If you grow canola, you might have less paperwork to do this season. The Australian Oilseed Federation has just launched a new simplified certification system for those selling into the European Union, which is Australia's biggest customer. Nick Goddard is head of the organisation, and he says canola growers who hate red tape should be happy.
As most growers will be aware, if they intend to have their canola shipped to Europe, which is our number one customer, they have to go through a fair bit of paperwork and rigmarole in order to declare and then certify that canola is being grown under certain conditions which the EU require. Now, in the past, this has exposed growers to a lot of paperwork. They've had to fill out declaration forms for each trader that they supply to. It's also exposed growers to potential of numerous audits by independent auditors that come along. So what the new process does is streamlines that whole thing right down to the completion of just one grower declaration. So a grower need only complete one grower declaration and is then potentially subject to only one audit instead of multiple audits. So it's about simplifying the process from a grower perspective and just getting costs and complications out of the system.
So this new system includes most large grain companies in Australia, but not CBH. Why are they not part of this?
Yeah, look, CBH has already got a great system in place and they've been actually quite instrumental in helping us develop this system for the rest of the industry, particularly in the early days. CBH is just sort of sitting on the sidelines at the moment. They don't want to, let's say, throw the baby out with the bathwater, so they've got a system that works. They don't want to switch over to a new system until this is, I guess, earned its stripes. But we're very confident this new system, which is integrated with the NGR, National Grower Register, process will in fact produce quite a lot of savings both for the traders and for growers. And you know, in the worst case scenario for WA growers, if they want to trade with CBH and another trader, they'll have to fill out maximum of two forms, but if they only want to deal with one or a collection of the others, then it's one form each.
So this certification for selling to the EU, does that apply to GM canola as well?
Yes, all canola, whether it's GM or non-GM. So Europe is increasingly taking GM canola. Most people will be aware that Canada's having trouble with China at the moment. So therefore, they're sitting on a lot of canola and Europe is beckoning. Europe's had a very poor crop this year. So Europe is sort of easing its view on GM and non-GM, and they've certainly become more receptive to taking GM canola for their biofuel market. And so, therefore, the declarations apply to both GM and non-GM canola out of Australia.
So this season, what does it mean for growers to have this new system in place?
Well, it should really simplify things. If instead of filling out multiple declaration forms for each trader that they might choose to sell to, they should only need to fill out one, or if they're also dealing with CBH, then two. And it also makes it a lot easier for traders. There's one common repository where the grower declarations sit. That's within the NGR system, and they can be accessed by any trader who's dealing with that grower. And ultimately, for growers next year, when audit time comes around, the chances of being audited have been significantly reduced by basically bringing all the growers under the one umbrella.
So this season has seen mixed, seasons across Australia. How's the national canola crop looking?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, it's getting worse day by day. Let's just tick off the good spots, and that's Victoria. Victoria's looking very good. The traditional Wimmera area is looking very good, and that will basically bring home the bacon for this year. But South Australia, day by day, is deteriorating, and we're seeing 30-degree-plus days at the moment there. And, of course, WA has had a string of hot weather in recent weeks, and that's also not doing well for what was already a fairly low number on canola. As most would be aware, it was a late break, so there wasn't a lot of canola in, but what is there has been knocked around a bit by the heat. And, of course, New South Wales, anything north of about Sydney is non-existent, and anything south of Sydney is rapidly deteriorating, right down to the Murray border. Yeah, look, it's not a terrific picture this year. It's a bit unfortunate. We've got a terrific market in Europe. They are short this year. They will be certainly buying on the world market. They're buying from the Ukraine at the moment. They'll be starting to access Canada, and they will take some Australian canola, particularly out of Western Australia, but we won't be able to supply the sort of millions of tonnes that we might like to supply and that we have certainly been able to supply in the past.
Australian Oilseed Federation Chief Executive Nick Goddard with Emma Field. And the traders involved in this new accreditation scheme for canola into the EU include Cargill, Bunge, ADM, Glencore and GrainCorp. And Emma did ask Jason Craig why CBH doesn't want to use this new Australian Oilseeds EU accreditation scheme.
Our CBH's scheme has been working for a number of years and has been successful since about 2010. We said we would look at the Australia-wide scheme, and we'll certainly continue to assess that. But, we wanted to remain with our system because, you know, it had been successful since 2010, and we're very clear, and we do a lot of work in terms of, helping growers get through the audit process, etc. And so we think that is a benefit to WA growers.
CBH's Jason Craig, 18 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Let's just have a wider look, I guess, at the situation for the crop across Australia, because as we've just been hearing, the widespread drought conditions are having a significant impact on the country's crop production, with a 9% fall in the winter crop this year. The crop of 27.7 million tonnes is the lowest in more than a decade, with the country's overall wheat, barley and canola production figures all down between 7 and 16%. Queensland has been particularly hit hard, along with, of course, Western Australia, where there's been a 33% drop in production levels. Rabobank's senior grains analyst Cheryl Kalish-Gordon says WA's grains industry is suffering due to the dry conditions.
WA last year was the state that really made the difference for Australia as a total, as a grain producer. They came in with close to 18 million tonnes. And this year we're looking at that being not even 12 million tonnes. So that's 33% down on last year. And that's because of the dry story has really moved to the west, as well as being across the rest of the nation. They had a very hot, dry summer that meant they had no soil moisture going into the season. They had a late break, which is less than, you know, desirable for crop performance. And then they had, just that hand-to-mouth rainfall that just got the crop along, in most parts, but really just never let the crop get to its yield potential or top yield potential. And then we've had a dry finish, hot dry finish, but then it's the frost that overlaid that. And so the frost event during September that was particularly focused on the Esperance area was really bookended by the fact that we had unseasonably hot conditions pre and post the frost and low rainfall, and that really exacerbated the impact.
So overall, what does this mean?
Look, this means we're in for an ongoing period of elevated pricing in Australia, with basis running at above average levels compared to global prices. At least for the next 12 months, we would expect, you know, a lot will happen. It depend on whether we get a crop in next year, but it is a long time between now and next year's crop. Plus, we're not looking at favourable prospects for the East Coast summer crop, with dam levels very low and rainfall forecasts not supporting a good summer crop program. So we are looking at a very tight balance sheet continuing going forward, elevated pricing, possibly not to the same level on the East Coast as last year, simply because we do have more grain on the East Coast compared to last year. The biggest challenge in my mind is what this means when we come out of the drought and we have to think about maintaining market positioning in our export markets. So being missing from markets with that low export surplus for a couple of years really does challenge our ability to go back into markets when we do have a bumper crop again, which we will do.
Have we seen a period like this in recent years where there is a lot of lower production levels, or is this what we tend to expect when there is such a wide spread drought?
Look, if we're looking at parallels to where we are now, we do need to go back 10 years to the millennium drought. 2007-08 had lower production and lower exports than this year. We are looking at a prospect now of having that same lingering impacts of prolonged drought as we move and when we move out of this particular dry period. So those impacts include not only the export challenges that I mentioned earlier, but a lot of farmers will have challenged cash flow positions for some time, but there are also soil and resource management issues to consider, for example, the onset of weeds in the wake of a prolonged drought period.
Rabobank Senior Grains Analyst Cheryl Kalish-Gordon with Tim Fuchs. And Cheryl was just saying that she's estimating now for Western Australia a total harvest of 12 million tonnes. I'm trying to think back to the last GIWA, the Grain Industry of Western Australia, forecast for Western Australia's crop. I think it was around about the 14 million mark. The new report is out this Friday, the 25th, so we'll take a look and compare the difference between what Rabobank's saying around that 12 million mark to what Guy was anticipating. We'll get to that on Friday's Country Hour. 23 past 12. And news headlines and a look at the weather around Western Australia not too far away at 12:30 today. First, though, Chinese-owned miner Sinosteel has unveiled plans to revive its iron ore mine at Blue Hills, 84 kilometres east of Morowa in the Midwest. Pending final approvals, the Blue Hills Extension Project could create 130 new jobs. Sinosteel is now the dominant player in the Midwest iron ore industry. It recently purchased Mitsubishi Development's Jack Hills project and the company which owns the intellectual property for the Oakajee Port and Rail project. Sinosteel Midwest spokesman Stuart Griffiths says he'll now conduct a review into the two new assets and hopes to be mining at Blue Hills by next year.
Sinosteel has other resources in the Midwest which rely on infrastructure development to develop them. We were very interested in the synergies it would give. The Crosslands Jack Hills project, a 3.9 billion tonne magnetite resource, is next to another billion tonne magnetite resource that Sinosteel Midwest has at Jack Hills. The resource also extends into the tenements of Sinosteel as well, so there's upside from a resource perspective. And we've also got the majority of the tenure there, so an infrastructure location and design, I think improvements could be achieved if it's done in a planned and progressive manner under one company developing it, then Sinosteel.
to be straightforward, and Oakajee is a bit of a poison chalice, it's probably fair to say, in the Midwest. Is that something that you're considering at all?
We're looking at what work has been done to date. A key part of the Oakajee Port and Rail project was also the inland rail. So there are parts of that we are interested in, and there are other parts that we will just look at to see whether or not we can make work. Until we do a thorough review of the project, we're not exactly sure of a way forward as yet, but we thought that there was value in the IP, particularly in the inland rail component.
There are rumours that Sinosteel paid $3 each, one for the Crosslands Resources and that intellectual property, that IP. Is that true?
So I'm unable to comment on the aspects of the deal with Mitsubishi.
Okay. Well, if we go back to 2011, Mitsubishi paid $325 million for a half share in Crosslands Resources. With that in mind, can we say you got a bargain?
You can read into it however you wish.
If we look at the Blue Hills project near Morowa, that was closed in 2015. 2 years ago, that was approved for expansion. What are your plans for Blue Hills?
We'd like to recommence mining at Blue Hills as soon as we can. We're just working through the final stages of the secondary approvals with the relevant government departments, but we pretty well think we'll have those shortly.
When do you think you might be able to strike a blow there?
Well, we would hope that we'd be mining 2020. We were hoping to be mining this year. The iron ore price is strong. We were very keen to be already started. We certainly hope we're going to be started by 2020.
So what was the hold-up, Stuart?
It just takes time to work through the secondary approvals.
And we're talking about the Blue Hills expansion plan. What's the life of that mine? What's the details of what you're expecting to be extracting from there?
We expect that to be about 3 years and be running at around about 2 million tonne per annum rate.
And would that be going through the Geraldton port?
Yes.
And jobs, Stuart? Any idea of what sort of employment opportunities we could be looking at there?
We also have around about 130 people working for us. That's with contractors as well. It is from diesel fitters to the local mechanic to water truck drivers to environmentalists to heritage surveys. So there is always a lot of work that comes about when you develop and when you start a mine.
Sinosteel Midwest Group of Companies Chief Executive Stuart Griffiths with Joe Prendergast, and talking about those plans to revive its iron ore mine at Blue Hills. And here at the ABC, it's always hard to not think of the old long-running ABC radio drama Blue Hills whenever that comes up. And so long, 1949 to 1976, that drama ran on the radio. That is a long time. ABC WA, it's 27 past 12. Well, the mining industry's uptake of autonomous technology can sound pretty ominous, but it doesn't necessarily mean doom and gloom and job losses. Sean Chow works with the economics, strategy and data analytics firm Alphabeta, which has recently wrapped up a study looking at the economic impact of automation technology on the mining sector. He says automation in mining could add $65 billion of value to the sector by 2030 and actually boost jobs across the supply chain.
Yeah, so even when we looked at direct losses in primary firms, we saw that there was two effects. So one would be there would be some losses in some of the automatable jobs like truck drivers, but these would also be partly compensated by new jobs. So, you know, the sexy type jobs like data scientists and computer analytics and visual imaging, but also a lot of other jobs around maintenance or putting in some of the automation technology. So there might be a small net direct job loss, but when we actually considered that altogether with the supply chain and the wider economy, the net effect was positive. We looked at a few case studies. So we looked at autonomous haulage, and in autonomous haulage we saw that there was potentially a up to 60 to 80% reduction in direct autonomous haulage jobs, but that would be partly compensated for other jobs that would be created, such as maintenance or vehicle support. But that overall, there would be a 7% net increase in jobs as a result of the increase in jobs in the supply chain and the wider economy.
You looked at a few different scenarios, and I was quite interested because you mentioned there that if the industry, the mining industry, focused on collaborating with the local supply chain, we would see this net increase of employment by 7%. But there was also a bit of a caveat to that forecast, wasn't there?
Yeah, so in the downside case, there will be a sort of 225,000 jobs fewer in the Australian economy by 2030 compared to the upside case if the local supply chain didn't fully participate in these automation technologies. So the real crux of the automation technology development is involving the local supply chain in the development of the technology.
And that would reduce the value proposition to the economy as well, I suppose.
Yeah, it would reduce the value proposition by about $25 billion as well. So it's important.
So when you say getting the local supply chain involved, what does that mean and how do we do it?
From our perspective, we think this is a unique moment actually for mining in Australia and particularly WA. There's a number of firms who are introducing automation technology here, and there's a leadership versus the rest of the world that's been created that's actually quite unique. We'd like to see a cluster created, a sort of robotics and automation cluster created in WA or potentially Queensland that capitalizes on that leadership in automation technology, bringing together government, industry groups, operators, supply chain and researchers.
Alphabetta's Sean Chow with John Daly. And just this text through, we were talking of Blue Hills the mine, but it made me think of Blue Hills, the ABC radio drama, which ran from 1949 to 76. And Dennis has just texted through asking to play the theme song. Well, that might be a little challenge for Richard Hudson on the other side of the glass between now and the news at one. Can he do it? I'm not sure. I don't know if he looks keen. Anyway, we'll see. Stay listening between now and 1 o'clock and you'll find out whether he manages the task. Let's get an update from the newsroom because Sandra Shimanberg's in the studio. Hello.
Hello, Belle. Thank you. Two men have avoided jail time after punching and stomping on a man at a Bunbury pub. Travis George Lorraway and Joseph Malcolm Rotimer were charged with assault occasioning bodily harm following the incident in February, which left the man with bleeding to the brain and broken ribs. Western Australia's voluntary assisted dying bill is at risk of being delayed because of a push to hold another inquiry before a final vote. Queensland is to hold an inquiry into allegations of the abuse and mistreatment of retired racehorses after reports aired on the ABC last week. Anastasia Palaszczuk has announced the inquiry and says it will be overseen by the state's Racing Integrity Commission. And in domestic cricket, injury has forced Western Australia to make three changes to its Marsh One Day Cup squad for tomorrow's day-night clash against Victoria at the WACA ground. Ashton Turner returns from injury to lead WA, while Aaron Hardy and Lance Morris have been added to the squad. Belle, I'll be back at 1 o'clock with a full bulletin.
Thank you for the update, Sandra. 27 to 1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good to have you along this afternoon. Still to come, the federal government has made some changes to the need for independent observers on all livestock export ships. So we'll talk about that with the Australian Livestock Exporters Council and then a response to that from the RSPCA. That's between now and the news at one. And also the results of the Mouchet sheep market, of course, being a Tuesday afternoon. So we'll get to that just before the news at one. And on the ABC Rural Facebook page, really keen to get your response to this. The question is, what should be done about the 24 million feral pigs in Australia? Now, of course, this is a really hot topic at the moment due to the fact that African swine fever is, you know, gradually making its way closer and closer to Australia. Hopefully, there's enough systems in place to keep it out of Australia, but it has travelled very rapidly through China and then into other parts of sort of Southeast Asia. So the question is, what should be done about these 24 million feral pigs in Australia? Because if it did get into this country, the experts say that this is really the way it's going to spread. It's not going to kill off the feral pigs. Apparently they can kind of move about without a worry. But it can spread that way through that population. So what should be done? Answer that question on the ABC Rural Facebook page. You can text to 0448 922 604. Off to the Weather Bureau, Austin Watkins. How's it looking in northern and eastern parts?
Afternoon, Belinda. Well, we've got a trough extending from the Pilbara to the Eucla today, and that's been fairly active as we speak, and lots of activity yesterday. So we'll see a similar thing tomorrow. So expecting, once again, showers and thunderstorms through sort of mainly central and eastern parts of the Pilbara, and that extends right through the interior into the Eucla as well, and also expect some afternoon shower and thunderstorm activity about the coastal parts of the Kimberley. And by Thursday, that activity will contract a little bit more as that trough moves eastward. So only expecting that shower and thunderstorm activity through the Kimberley, the north interior and eastern parts of the Pilbara. And then by Friday, we expect that the activity contract even further as that ridge is really pushed up into the north of the state. So just expecting mainly shower, afternoon shower, thunder and thunderstorm activity through the Kimberley and the north interior on Friday. And then by Saturday, expecting the trough to redevelop back towards the Pilbara and the northern Gascoyne. So we'll just see that shower and thunderstorm activity developing back through there during the afternoon. Very patchy falls and activity through those northern and eastern parts over the next few days.
And into the southwest land division, how's it looking?
Yeah, so the main influence over the next few days will be the passage of a weak front during tomorrow, and then a ridge building across the south of the state. So we're expecting the front to reach the Capes around sunrise tomorrow morning, and then sort of lie roughly between sort of the Perth region and down towards Bremer Bay by late afternoon. So we'll see a band of showers slowly creep up through those southwestern districts during the course of the day. Pretty light falls expected, really, only sort of a few millimetres at best for some of those southwest locations. As we move into Thursday, that front will just be through that Esperance region during the morning, and then it'll move into the Bight during the day. But there will be some shower activity behind that front along the southern coastal districts during the day, and even some early shower activity just before sunrise through coastal parts of the west coast, sort of north of Bunbury as well. Once again, generally light falls associated with that. After that, a new ridge of high pressure builds along the south of the state during Friday and Saturday. So we'll just see some residual shower activity along the western south coast on Friday. And then conditions generally clear up for Saturday. But we will be in for some cooler, milder days once this front moves through. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, most centres through central and southern parts will be experiencing some cooler days. But later parts on Saturday, we'll see a trough develop near the west coast. So so temperatures returning sort of to the to low the mid-30s through the central west and northern parts of the central wheat belt there.
Warnings this afternoon?
Yes, we've got a strong and warning current. That's for sort of areas from Exmouth down to Shark Bay. That's for tomorrow. And also the western south coastal areas from Bremer Bay to Cape Lewin, also for tomorrow. And we've also got a fire weather warning current for northern parts of the state.
Thank you very much for that, Austin. 22-1. No rainfall over 5 millimetres anywhere across Western Australia in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. Dennis, guess what I found? When you want to do a job, you just get it done yourself, really. No thanks to Richard. Here it is for you, the Blue Hills theme song, just a bit.
The ABC presents Blue Hills by Gwen Meredith.
21-1. I think I'd recognise it straight away. I wonder if I just played it, you'd guess it, wouldn't you, straight away? I think so. It is 21-1 and getting to the Mouchet Sheep Market just before the news at 1 o'clock. I'm asking you too, what should we do with the 24 million feral pigs in Australia? This through from Paul in Nanup, get the army to shoot them. It'll be good practice for them. And James says, That's EasyBell, $200 bounty for each wild pig handed in to the appropriate authorities. Your thoughts on the text, 0448 922 604. To some important news in the live export trade now. And the federal government has changed its policy on having independent observers on all livestock export ships, moving instead to a risk-based approach, which will see observers no longer required on most short-haul voyages between Northern Australia and Southeast Asia. The Observer program was introduced last year in an effort to improve traceability and public trust in the industry, but it came at a cost, with some trips costing exporters more than $40,000 to pay for the Observer. To get a better understanding of the changes to the Observer program, here's Mark Harvey Sutton from the Australian Livestock Exporters Council.
What has been announced is that the Australian government will be moving to a performance-based process for administering the Independent Observer program. Up until now, independent observers have been required to be on all vessels. There have been a few exemptions to that. For instance, if a vessel can't physically house an independent observer, so some of the smaller vessels might have come across that. But in essence, every vessel has been required to have one of these independent observers. And what government has taken, based on all the reports that the independent observers have provided since they were introduced, is that there is grounds to move to a system that actually rewards good performance. And that's certainly something that we're very much welcoming of.
Speaking to those within the trade, they see this as essentially removing independent observers from short-haul voyages. Is that correct?
It's highly likely that's correct, Matt, because what they're actually moving to is a risk-based or performance-based system, as I said. They're going to take into account things like the duration of the voyage, where the voyage will be going, what the consignment consists of. So, you know, is it a mixed consignment or purely cattle? But what we can take from that and what we can take from the reports that have been provided so far is that it seems those short-haul voyages are going to be the real beneficiaries out of this decision.
And what will that mean for industry?
What it will mean is a significant reduction in costs, Matt. So the independent observers, the program has been administered on a cost recovery basis, which means that exporters have to pay for the observer to be on the vessel. And what the IO does is actually observe conditions on a daily basis on a vessel. But obviously there's a range of reporting requirements on vessels. So the stockman, the accredited vet is also required to do reports. So, you know, what we're seeing is, given that breadth of reporting and given the outcomes of the reports from the independent observers, those that have a proven track record and proven good performance, they won't be required to have that observer. And that will be a cost saving to them.
What's classified as short-haul voyage? As in, where is the threshold, Mark Harvey Sutton?
That information I don't have at the moment. We're still waiting for clear clarification coming from the department about what these changes will mean and how they'll be administered in a practical effect.
Does the industry have its own interpretation on what the difference is between a short-haul and a long-haul voyage?
Oh, look, I think you can draw a pretty safe conclusion that markets such as Vietnam and Indonesia, shipments there would be classified as short haul. I think as you start to move into voyages that are a bit longer than that, you're probably starting to come into the long haul. Certainly vessels that are going to the Middle East would be classified as long haul. So there's no set definition, Matt, but I think there are some very clear short haul voyages that take place, for instance, from Darwin to Indonesia. I think some of those can take as little as 4 days. So, you know, there's some very clear short-haul voyages in the system.
And news of this decision, has it already filtered through at a practical level? Like, are you aware of, say, a ship leaving Darwin next week that all of a sudden no longer requires an independent observer?
I'm not exactly sure how the implementation is going to take place, and that's what we need to find out.
Okay.
But certainly, in speaking to exporters and our members, they are very welcoming of this. They'd be keen to see it come into place as soon as possible. And I think it's a really important change, Matt, because what we are seeing is that shift towards performance-based. And we know there are excellent performers in the industry, and that's what should be rewarded, and that's what this decision is doing.
Mark Harvey Sutton, he is the CEO of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council, catching up with Matt Brann. In a statement from the Federal Department of Agriculture, it says the government has removed the requirement for independent observers to accompany every low-risk voyage, such as short-haul livestock export voyages. But the department says it may still direct independent observers to accompany other voyages if it considers it necessary. 12:45 here on the Country Hour. And the RSPCA has criticised the federal government's decision to remove these observers from some livestock export ships, saying it should have been consulted over changes to the policy. As you've just heard, under the new risk-based approach, these observers will no longer be required on those short-haul voyages between Northern Australia and Southeast Asia. The RSPCA's senior policy officer, Jed Goodfellow, says the move is a backward step for animal welfare.
The RSPCA is concerned about this latest development. The observer program was established in order to provide independent validation of onboard conditions and also to provide further assurances to the community about those conditions. So to see that only 18 or so months later, we're seeing a fairly significant watering down of that program is quite concerning. So we think the decision is premature. We believe that first there should have been consultation on this development so that other stakeholders can provide their input. But it seems that the government's making this decision first and doing consultation later.
So cattle exporters obviously have welcomed this move, saying what it does is reward good performance in regards to animal welfare. Isn't that a fair point? Shouldn't they be freed of the significant cost burden of inspectors if they can consistently prove they're doing the right thing?
Look, there are still concerns in the live cattle trade. We do acknowledge that the risks of sending sheep to the Middle East going over the equator and sending southern breeds of cattle over the equator do present greater risks for animal welfare than northern breeds of cattle going up into Southeast Asia. Nevertheless, the northern cattle, live cattle trade is not without risk and it's not without its problems. So the whole point of this observer program was to provide that independent validation of onboard conditions, and there is still a need for that to occur. So we're willing to work with the Australian government in terms of looking at alternative models for providing that independent validation. But it is concerning that the government's already made the decision to pull those observers off those vessels prior to engaging in that consultation. So it does seem to be a familiar policy cycle where we see after an expose of a horrible animal welfare incident, there's many commitments and promises made by the government. And then once the public scrutiny subsides, we do see a process of watering down regulations and going back on commitments that have been made. And this seems to be another example of that.
You mentioned the RSPCA is looking at alternate models and working with the government on that. Where are you up to with that, and what are the sort of standouts there for you at the moment?
One of the options could be technological mechanisms for providing that independent validation, such as the installation of CCTV on board the vessels. That could be a source of monitoring. Alternatively, I mean, we could also be looking at different approaches to the appointment of the veterinarians and the Australian government accredited stock people on board the vessels as well. So to provide, again, that level of independence from the exporter.
Jed Goodfellow from the RSPCA with Carmen Brown. 12:01.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
The National Farmers Federation is calling on all levels of government to coordinate a cull of Australia's 24 million feral pig population. Now, this has popped up because there's this growing feeling that feral pigs will be largely responsible for the spread of African swine fever if it enters the country. Tony Maher is the chief executive of the National Farmers Federation, and he says the time is right for a nationally coordinated cull.
Right now, at the moment, it's a good time to actually take these steps. We're obviously experiencing devastating drought, and the last thing we need is further difficulties and challenges from pests such as pigs. So it certainly seems like a good time at the moment for the government to initiate such an initiative, and notwithstanding the drought, but also, you know, possibly linked to the African swine fever risk that we know is on our doorstep.
So have you got specifics of what you want? How much funding you want to be put toward this? What sort of resources? What control methods could be used?
Look, we haven't gone into that level of detail. We've just been talking about it at our NFF Members Council last week, and it had unanimous support for us to talk with government, and we have been talking with them around a range of measures, obviously relating to the drought, and it became apparent that this could be another area where the government could assist the industry and take some steps, particularly at the moment, around controlling feral pests such as pigs.
Do you think the feral pig problem has flown under the radar or crept up on the government, and now we're at a point where there's 24 million feral pigs out there and it might be difficult to wind that back?
Well, I think it's been an ongoing issue, and I think right now, just at the moment, it's being exacerbated because of the conditions that a large part of the country is facing in terms of drought. So the appears like it's a good time to actually do this sort of thing. Now, we could debate about whether it's gotten out of control, but right now it's looking for measures that will make a difference. And if we could get some sort of process in place or project in place where the government worked with local communities, state governments, whoever it might be, to actually help control this pig problem, not underestimating the challenge. I mean, it's going to take a pretty significant impact, and that's where, again, I think we probably need cooperation across Commonwealth and state, and possibly, you know, local governments as well. So, but if we continue to let it go, you know, it's not going to get any better.
Tony Maher, he's the Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation with Angus Verley, and he thinks it is possible to keep African swine fever out of Australia as long as there's cooperation between farmers, various levels of government, and the Federal Agriculture Minister, Bridget McKenzie. And we have contacted her for comment on this call from the NFF to back a serious feral pig cull. On the ABC Rural Facebook page, we're asking you, what do you think should be done about the 24 million feral pigs currently running wild in Australia? Lots of comments. Stuart says, eat them. Eve says, could we create a hunting industry, making money and let people enjoy their sport? Same with foxes, rabbits and other feral species. This from Zed, stop locking out hunters from forests and ridiculous gun control between states on legal gun owners should be the same laws across all Australia. If you are a licensed gun owner in one state, it should be valid in all states. And this from Linda, give one to each Australian to keep in their backyard as a pet. That's what they want to do with ex-racehorses, isn't it? You can be part of that conversation on the ABC Rural Facebook page, 8-1. We'll get to the livestock markets, the Mouchay sheep market shortly. But first, you might have heard in the news that at the end of last week, a man went missing in Western Australia's wheat belt. He got bogged near Killarney, which is roughly 3 hours' drive northeast of Perth. His name is Matthew Boyd, and he is still missing. Now, we've managed to track down Matthew's dad, Shane. He's in that area right now trying to find his son.
We know Matthew was with his partner on Wednesday morning, and they were supposed to be going to quarter, and for some reason Matt decided to detour, and they went on to a bit of Salt Lake. So where, what he was doing, I don't know. They got themselves bogged. They got themselves out of the bog, and of course Matt had been having a little bit of trouble with his power steering, and the vehicle, once it got out of the bog, he really couldn't go too far in it. So we don't know exactly what happened after that, but his partner went south and Matthew went in the north direction. His partner was able to find a house after 2 days, Friday morning, and she rang us up straight away. Well, then we rang her back, and then our next door neighbour to go pick her up. The next door neighbour had a bit of a look around, then rang us back when we were on our way down Esperance, and then asked them to call emergency services.
So that's when really the first message got through to emergency services, 2 days after he'd already been out there. What has happened in terms of a search since then, since Friday when the alarm was first raised?
Okay, so that we know, some people, mainly police officers, I think, went out Friday night, okay? And then Saturday morning, I don't know whether the horses were up there but we know but the emergency services were there, police were there. I think one or two tracking people were there as well. I don't think the aeroplanes come in until Monday, and since Monday they've been getting more resources, more people every day. And as I said, the helicopters coming out today.
Is he someone who's used to sort of being in the bush or being in rural areas?
Yes, he is. Yes, he is, because we actually used to live in Quarter, which is about 70 k's south of what we're talking about. But for some reason, they're only mostly about 800 metres or 600 metres away from what we call farming land that joined onto the salt lake. But for some reason, we haven't been able to find it.
What are you hoping may have happened?
Mostly at the moment, 100 things are going through our heads. We would have thought, after looking at it, that he would have said that there was a night when they separated. So most probably he might have walked a little bit and then tried to have a sleep. Wake up the next day, just depending on what was confronted to him, I suppose. But if you saw any farming land, I would have been sure that he would have actually gone straight to the farming land, because he knows that either there should have been either dams and water in the paddocks, and he just kept on walking until he found the road. But especially up here, there's not that many farm houses that are left on the roads, and where his partner was very fortunate she was able to find a house. Matt's got a sore leg, so he really can't walk all that fast. So we're just hoping that, one, we can find him. He might be in a bad state, but hopefully still be okay.
So would you have a message for people that are perhaps travelling in the area or farmers in the area?
I actually decided to ring because of from the area. I actually rang people that I knew that were on the east side of the lake, even though the helicopters or the planes said they haven't seen tracks going across there. I thought I'd still ring there. And at least three farmers were going out and checking their boundaries and dams and water troughs this morning, which is good, and some have already done it. The whole hassle is that the trackers haven't been able to pick up the tracks, and that's been the biggest, because how do you know where to start unless you know where the person is?
Shane Boyd, he's the father of missing man Matthew Boyd, who's been missing now for 6 days, just near Killarney in WA's Wheat Belt, and Shane was talking to Natasha Harradine. So keep an eye out if you are in that area. Shane Boyd is described as fair-skinned, slim build, approximately 183 centimetres tall, so that's about 6 foot, brown hair and brown eyes. He was last seen wearing a black motocross shorts and black shoes. If you think you've seen Matthew, or you think you have some information that might be helpful to find him, please call police on 131 444. That's 131 444. 3-1. To the Mouche sheep market now, and numbers were up by about 800 on last week. Almost 13,500 sheep and lambs sold today. Tracy Kilner is at Mouche. How did the sale go, Tracy?
A mixed quality yarding saw lambs gain while the mutton remained firm on the heavyweights and gained $5 to $10 on store ewes. Heavyweight lambs in score 3 condition in the carcass weight range of 22 to 24 kilos sold for $150 to $169 to return an average of 659 cents per kilo, up 15 cents on last week. Trade weight lambs in the 20 to 22 kilo range gained $8, selling for $135 to $157 to return an average of 681 cents a kilo carcass weight. Score 2 lightweight merino new and old season lambs made from 48 to 97 depending on quality. Young merino ewes gained to sell from 51 to 129, averaging $97 a head with grazier competition. Heavyweight ewes over 24 kilos carcass weight sold from $100 to $146, including skins, to average 397 cents a kilo carcass weight. Light score 2 boning ewes down to 17 kilos carcass weight made from 75 to 125 carrying a full fleece, and very light ewes sold for as low as $42 a head. Good prime medium weight ewes in the 18 to 24 kilo carcass weight range made from $89 to $105 a head. Young wethers sold from $55 to $136, averaging $95, while the older wethers made from $71 to $125, for lightweights and 110 to 155, including skins for the heavier weights over 24 kilos carcass weight. Rams sold from $10 to $90 depending on age and weights, averaging $62 a head, and the ram lambs returned $37 to $145 quality dependent to average $98 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for going through those details at the Mouche sheep market, where almost 13,500 sheep and lambs sold today. And more sheep and lambs are going to be auctioned tomorrow. This is at the Katanning sheep market. So this time tomorrow, that's where you'll be, at the Katanning sheep market. And then it's Mount Barker cattle market Thursday and a wrap of the wool market on Friday. Look forward to talking to you tomorrow. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.